All right, great. Well, Noah, thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate it. It's a treat for me to get a younger, energetic guy who's done everything that you've done in your career on. So it's really great to have you.
Yeah, great to be here. Thanks for having me, and I'm excited about the chat.
All right, cool. We'll definitely post a link to your LinkedIn profile on the video somewhere. Kyler will take care of that. And where are you in the world right now?
So I'm in Dallas, Texas right now. I'm in our variable office in the west end of downtown.
Okay, so you guys are in the office now. You've returned to the office since the COVID sort of semi-reopening.
Yeah, we have the we had a lot of our team out remote for a couple months, and we came back and kind of had a in and out moment, while there was kind of a spike there for a bit. But now the cases are actually falling pretty steadily here in Dallas, so we're all
Okay.
back in.
So everyone came back in. Did you have anyone that was sort of resisting coming back in?
A little bit, yeah. There was a little few sort of mixed opinions there, and we took it case by case. It's a very personal decision to kind of figure out, hey, this is where my comfort level lies. And so we took it case by case. Some people took a little longer to come back. Some people stayed remote. Different situations that live with older folks, and so we just kind of again took it case by case basis. And now we're pretty much all back.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Yeah, we're kind of doing the same thing, but we have a big majority that have not come back yet. So I
Yeah.
think out of 40 employees, I think we have maybe seven that have come back, including
Yeah.
the two owners. So
Ah.
it's yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, it's strange times. It's COVID has definitely penetrated everywhere, and I have mixed feelings about masks and all of that, but I do respect everyone's perspective on it. Everybody has different fears and concerns and situations. I mean, older folks are more susceptible than younger folks are, and some places are more hot spots than others, and you got to factor all that in.
How do you feel about the effectiveness of remote workers versus, in-house 40, 50 people under the same roof,
Sure.
as opposed to scattered all over? Let's just keep it to North America. So as opposed to scattered all over North America, how do
Yeah,
you feel about the effectiveness?
that's a good question. In my prior company, TouchTap, so I had a mobile development agency before Variable, and my prior company, we were all fully remote across North America, essentially. So I definitely believe that remote workers can be effective, that we have all the tools nowadays to make remote workers effective. I mean, we all work in office here at Variable, but we're on Slack 24/7. We've got all kinds of tools that really help us with our online workflow and things like that. So I think remote workers can be effective. I think when remote workers are the most effective, at least I've seen this at Variable, has been when the team culture is sort of in place and bonding the team together really strong. You don't necessarily have to be in front of someone to know how they're going to react or what they're saying in a Slack message or in an email if you know that person, right? If you have done time with that person, essentially either in the office or in certain different ways in remote as well. So I think team culture is what really makes things fast.
Yeah, that's a good point. And if someone is a good worker and a good collaborator, they'll find a way to succeed remotely. Because let's
Right.
face it, we were all forced into this remote situation, so we had no choice but to see if it's going to work. I'm very pleased actually with the results. I was so anti-remote for a decade, but
Yeah.
yeah, it made me realize that, you know what, if someone's not good, they're not going to be good in the office or at home,
Yeah.
So it's vice versa as well. So you mentioned Variable, so you're the co-founder and CTO.
That's right. Yep.
Okay, can you tell us a little bit about Variable?
Yeah, absolutely. So Variable is an on-demand marketplace for manufacturing labor. So that's a mouthful. So we're the Uber for the shop floor. If you want to, everybody has an Uber tagline. That's ours.
Okay.
And so we provide businesses with the opportunity to have flexible labor capacity. So bring in essentially a third labor paradigm as their demand rises and falls, they can manage their workforce to meet or to meet those demand needs. From a worker standpoint, we provide them the opportunity to create their own schedule, work for different companies, different you know, work opportunities, and also get paid daily. So it's a bit of a different scenario from a full-time manufacturing, you know, working 30 years in the shop floor, which doesn't really appeal to the younger generation.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of shop, like what kind of work are they, is it specific to like machine shop workers? Like
It runs the gamut, honestly. We primarily do a lot of distribution, warehouses, 3PLs, supply chain stuff. We do service manufacturing. We do some final mile work as well, some assembly, forklift driving, things of that nature. So pretty much anything around the industrial supply chain, we have workers that would fit in that scenario.
Okay, excellent. So that's interesting because you're in the IT web space throughout your career. I was looking at your LinkedIn, obviously, in preparation for this meeting. So it's interesting that you would build something for and succeed in something for, you know, a completely different industry, right? So now sure. My question is going to be staff augmentation in the web development world, because let's face it, you know, simply PHP's web development. Your portfolio is heavy on technology, web development, management. So a couple of questions. Is something like this applicable to the web development world? So that's number one. How do you feel about that? Now, like, I know there's a lot of freelance platforms out there that I guess are kind of similar. Mm. Would you find the platforms that are out there for web developers to be similar to what you have, except it's just a different space?
Yeah, sort of. I would say, you know, you comparing like freelancers or independent contractors for manufacturing, there are some definitely similarities in marketplaces built around those types of models, right? Mm-hmm. But I would say that so web development, app development, really just call it software development, period. It's a little more specialized than, say, you know, warehouse work or pick, pack, and ship, or you know, standing at the end of a conveyor belt packaging material. You need some training, you need some experience. So it's a little bit different. What we focus on is those the non-skilled, I would say non-skilled, lower skilled type of opportunities. So you look at a manufacturing operation, and you've got your high skilled positions, and then you've got your work that needs to be done, whether it's like final QA or receiving materials or pick, pack, and ship. Those things are repeatable tasks, right? You may have your specific ways that you want to do them at your business, but they're pretty much repeatable. You don't have to have specific training to do them. And that's a lot of what we focus on is, okay, we want you hire your full-time people in the more skilled positions, and then we will come in and augment the lower skilled type of stuff.
Oh, understood. So I could conceivably show up for work on Monday, like through your platform, and have maybe 20, 30 minutes of training, and then I'm good to go for that day.
Absolutely.
I've done those jobs.
Yeah.
I've done those jobs before. Okay.
Sure. Me too.
Yeah. So in that vein now, so let's pivot to when you were a software development leader, manager, and I'm sure even when you built a variable, when you are faced with the necessity to augment your staff. So you need to staff aug pretty quick. You're looking at the horizon. You're saying, you know what? I'm not going to make this timeline. It's impossible. Mm-hmm. You have to make it. I need to add, you know, three or four developers, you know, and a sysadmin, or let's just stick it to developers. You need to add three PHP developers. Mm-hmm. What is your process, or what was your process, you know, staffing up? Were you looking at full-time employees? Were you looking at going on the popular freelance websites? Were you looking at hiring a company? How was your decision made? And then I'm going to ask you, you know, what was your process to find the right people?
Sure. I answer both those questions. And I don't think I did it very effectively. So I can definitely
That's even better.
Yeah. So at Variable, it's always been full time. We've always really focused on bringing in a team, building an engineering team, because our tech is our product and we really want people to come in and own it. So that's been our goal from day one. But at TouchTap, I would ramp up and ramp down workforce all the time. And what I did, what I sort of chose to do at that time was to try to bring in individuals. I try to find individuals, maybe through LinkedIn, through my own network, bring in mobile developers, web developers, things like that, and sort of give them a try.
On a salary or like a contract basis?
Yeah.
Contract basis. Okay.
Yeah. So everybody on TouchTap at TouchTap, I'd say excluding a couple of people, were all contract. Okay. So it was all sort of project based. It was ramped up based on the work pipeline that we had. Mm-hmm. And what I figured out was after the fact, 2020 hindsight, it was really ineffective. Going and searching, you know, for individual people took a long time. There's a lot of risk. There was a lot of risk associated with that. It could have gone good, could have gone bad. A lot of times it went bad. And then I just wasted time and money and effort. So if I could go back and do that, I would look for sort of a maybe white label third party agency or group, kind of like Simply PHP, and partner with them. Maybe, you know, take on a project and get to know each other a little bit, but I would go back and try to find that partner to be, you know, tied at the hip with, to be able to ramp up and ramp down as needed. Because at the end of the day, it would have helped both. It would have helped my agency and would have helped the other partner I would have partnered with too. So, it was very ineffective the way I was going about it. And I learned a lot from it, but if I could go back, I'd do it differently.
Yeah, I could imagine. I can see it if you were trying to hire one resource, you can grab just an individual on a contract basis. But yeah, when there's more than one, I could see it being difficult.
Yeah.
But when you ramped up at TouchTap, did you have a lot of time to prepare for that ramp up, or was it just basically, hey, Monday morning, someone looked over everything on the weekend, came in Monday and said, this is not good, we need to hire. Like, how was that process?
It was a scramble. Yeah.
It was a scramble. Okay.
Yeah. It was like, okay, we got this new project, we're excited about it. Holy crap, we don't have anybody to do it. Let's go find some people. It was really stressful.
It's funny. It's like, that's basically our clients are pretty much like that. And it's always, you know, hey, I found you on Google, I found you on LinkedIn, whatever. And after the conversation, I'm like, okay, when do you envision this starting? As soon as possible.
Right.
I'm like, wow, okay. And it's pretty much like 80% of the time it's like that.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. I suspect so. You know, you get a project and when you got to ramp up, you got to ramp up then. You don't necessarily foresee the demand spike, right? You can forecast all you want, but basically forecasts are averages, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, you forecast all you want, but when that demand spikes, you're like, I got to go. I need people. I need process. I need, you know, requirements, and I got to go build this thing. And that makes sense that most of your clients that come to you are like that.
Yeah, it's really interesting. It's rare that we have someone call and say, okay, I'll get back to you in a month, or I'll get back mm-hmm. in 2 months. It's always something that's, you know, hot. That's why we staff up the way we do. Often we might have an extra one or two employees that are basically just on the bench learning, giving back to some nonprofit until we get that call when the person's ready.
Yeah.
But it's just the nature of the beast, right?
Absolutely.
I think it's also, again, going back to a company versus a group of freelancers, it's also great to be able to speak to ownership of that company or management of that company, you know, on a weekly basis and say, hey, you know, I'm happy with this guy, I'm not happy with that guy, maybe let's rotate that guy out, type of thing. Mm-hmm. And it's so seamless and easy that way, I find.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, that makes a ton of sense. That would have been really useful, having a partner like you guys early on, instead of cherry picking the people and then having to let go and then being sort of back at the scramble.
Yeah, it's tough. And a lot of times, unfortunately, it's the nature of the beast. You have people that just disappear, you know, they can't find them. And it's hard. I'm sure you have a lot of a lot of stories.
Yes.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Did you ever use a company? Or are you kind of looking back in hindsight and saying, okay, that's what I would do?
Primarily hindsight. There was a couple of smaller agencies that were my size, maybe 2-3 people. You know, mostly mine were, I think at that when we were max capacity, we were about 15 contractors. But not huge, and it was in and out. But there were some other companies that we worked with that were a bit smaller that we did partner with longer term. And that really sort of proved what we're talking about. You know, this an agency rather than a you know, singular person that you're connecting with.
Yeah, excellent. I always ask CTOs and people of your stature what the process is for finding that company is. And also, what was your process for finding the individual? Because, you know, we have in our viewership, we have a lot of individuals that are trying to make sure they're visible for people like you. And there's also companies like me that are always wanting to be visible to people like you. So can you give me, first go over the individuals, like what was your process for hiring an individual, and then the same thing for a company?
Yeah, sure. So the individuals, I think, is the easier one, really. I mean, there was the scramble. I would look at LinkedIn a lot. I would network. I would talk to other developers and see who they knew. And I would try to be doing that all the time, so that I would have, you know, resumes in my back pocket if I needed to try to reach out. Sometimes it didn't work out that way. Basically filtering the individuals to see if they were the right type of person, I would do an onboarding sort of project that they would come in and do some coding, some very small coding project kind of thing, just to prove that they weren't lying about their skills.
Okay, so you would actually have them code something that, like, I don't know, would take a day or something like that, like an 8-hour?
Yeah, and it would be take home. It wouldn't be something where I'd be grilling them, watching them on a Zoom call or something, you know. And it helped a lot. And I think that was more applicable to the individual scenario. But I would do that, the project, and then they would come on. And essentially for their first project, I would be sort of stay close with them on the work that they were doing and just make sure that they were measuring up. So it's kind of like sort of trial by fire. And I think that made sense from an individual standpoint. But when I looked for an agency, I looked for to work with. I looked for more like, okay, what work have they done? What's their portfolio? What does that look like? You know, what type of people are they working with? Do they have a specific industry niche, or are they pretty broad? I looked at, you know, if there's any sort of like Trustpilot ratings or any sort of marketplaces out there with ratings. Definitely would ask around if I knew anybody that knew the agency that I was looking at and be like, hey, have you worked with them before? Or, you know, try to reach out to people that they had worked with before. And then I tried to get on these with my agency a handful of times, but looking at the, you know, some people will post the, you know, top 10, you know, software development agencies of 2020, right? Mm-hmm. You know, those articles that different mediums will post. I would look at those too, and it would kind of give me at least a good starting point.
Really? You actually look at those top 10 companies? You know they're paying to be there, right?
I know.
That's good. That's interesting, because I always get those emails and they're saying, hey, would you like to be a part of the top 10 PHP developers in North America? And I'm like, of course.
Right.
I think we are. Yeah. And they're like, okay, here are our rates. And it's like, you know, $1,500 and $1,000. I'm like, okay, no, there's no credibility there. But right. I guess it works, you know. Like, you know, I always like companies that advertise, right? Because they're advertising and they're spending the money. So they I'm assuming they're doing business at least, right?
Right. That's right. And you did. I mean, they do. I totally know that they're paid. But they do get your attention. I mean, when people Google the top, you know, app developers or top mobile developer, top agencies or whatever, that's what pops up.
Yeah. That's very, very interesting. Okay. And so that's good. Yeah. I love back to the individual. I love getting the person in, whether it's remotely or physically, and making sure that they can code, because you don't want to waste their time either. Right? Last thing you want to do, and a lot of times when we hire people, they're actually leaving jobs that they have. So they're like, okay, you're hired. Okay, I'm going to give my 2 weeks notice. So you want to make sure that, you know, they're actually going to be compatible with you. We like doing that too. We get them to do, you know, set up their environment, do a couple of tasks in either a current project or a fake project. And yeah, I think that's really, really solid. And for the companies, yeah, so you go, you look at the reviews, obviously. You look at what they've done. Okay, so you look at the types of projects they've done.
That's right.
Yeah, interesting. But have you ever been sold by a really good salesman and it turns out that the company can't deliver anything?
I'm sure that I have. I'm trying.
True, right?
Oh, totally, totally. I mean, there's some really good salespeople out there, right?
Yeah.
You know, I think probably more, you know, some overseas smaller companies that I've worked with before on a very small term project. I think I've probably been burned more by that.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a whole other thing.
Other
podcast about the offshore. Yeah, we're in New York and everything's getting
right. different model, but yeah, I'm sure that I have. I maybe I've buried those memories on purpose.
Yeah, that's the thing that's been going on. So we're in our 10th year of business, and it's a thing that's been going on, you know, ever since I've been around the business. And it's the, you know, the sign in New York or California or Montreal, Toronto, and they're representing like they're a North American company, but they're just shipping it off and making a margin, shipping it off to India or Eastern Europe. And it never ends well. Like I talk to people on a weekly basis that got tripped up that way, and they try to get us to save them, which most of the time we can. It's really interesting. I find, to speak to what you said, I think when I speak to someone who's a prospective client, and they might, let's say they want one or two or three developers. In the end, they need, you know, before we go forward, they need to speak to those developers. In my opinion, it's super important because I can sell you on price, location. I've been selling this for 10 years, so I know everything to say. I know exactly what to say to you. But in the end, it's whoever is in that seat programming is what matters, you know? So I think that's super important too.
Absolutely. And we talked about this a little bit earlier, right? There's a little bit of a culture fit that you want to make sure is there, right? Because there's, you know, the term speed of trust, right? If someone's going to fit in the culture, they're going to fit in with how your team works, and there's going to be trust there, and you can move quickly, and everybody wants to move quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. Communication too, you know, like you want to be in a meeting, four or five people, and everyone's communication is on the same type of level, spirit. It's super important.
That's right.
So let's talk about Code Story. Code Story is interesting to me on a couple levels because I know you. So Code Story is a podcast that you do, and correct me if I'm wrong. And you basically specialize in engaging and speaking with co-founders, startup partners. Can you talk to me a little bit? And I have like a magic question after you explain the story a bit to me.
All right, I'm looking forward to the magic question.
It's fun. I almost ask all the time to people like you. So
cool. So Code Story, yep. So what I'm doing with Code Story is I'm interviewing CTOs, CEOs, basically tech visionaries, right, about their human story in building world-changing products, right, disruptive products. So, you know, if I interview a carpenter, he's going to tell me about his hammer, right, and his nails, right? So I interview tech folks, and they tell me about the frameworks they use to build software. So it's a tech podcast. It's a startup podcast. But the goal of it is to surface those human stories from the tech people about what they went through to build a product. Like, oh, yeah, I built my MVP, and it was ugly. And it was terrible. And, you know, like we were embarrassed to release it. And then I hired the team, and I hired, you know, 10 people, and three of them worked out, and I had to fire seven of them, you know, and like all of the nitty gritty startup stories that people, you don't really hear about as much.
So more the person who went through those business stories, like,
Yeah. Yeah. And from the tech side. So we want to surface the tech bits of how you're using the hammers to build the house. Right. So, you know, we'll talk about tech to scale. We'll talk about choosing technology, technical debt and things like that, but not from the standpoint of like, we're going to dissect the ones and zeros. It's more about this is the tool that I used and this is why I went that route. And this is where I was happy with that decision. And this is where that really bit me in the butt later. So, you know, it's more about from that seat and that perspective and as a human tech builder. So that's what Code Story is.
When you talk to them, technology wise, and you just said something that kind of piqued my interest, and you said, this is the hammer I use and this is why I chose this type of hammer. So that'll lead me to a question. What do you think drives people to choose a certain programming language and what should drive them? So basically, if you have a startup, now you have this experience talking to all these people, did they make a mistake when they chose a programming language, or what drove them to choose that programming language? And what should they take into account when they do choose a programming language? That's a lot of questions, but I think you know what I mean, right?
Oh, totally, totally. I'm totally tracking with you. You know, there's lots of different factors that go into that decision. I've found being one of the tech founders and also interviewing tech founders, you know, there's the kind of traditional look at it, right? Which is two things, right? Do you know it? Right. Is it what you know, so you can go build something quickly? Or is the other thing that I hear often is like, it's the right language, right? It's got the right tool set. It's got the right frameworks. It's stable. It's supported, things of that nature. So those sort of two things really go into it, when people are choosing a language. But there's a third element that I see sort of surfacing as technology for scalability and containerization and, things like that come more to the surface, is you can sort of choose the right language to do a piece of what you're trying to do, and deploy it. So, you know, if I want to write something kind of heavy data intensive, I can deploy a container that's written in Python, right? Mm-hmm. Or I can, you know, if I want to do something that's, you know, specific to, you know, doing some other sort of technical task, right? That's written a language that's written for a specific thing. I can build it, put it in a container, and I can deploy it wherever I want. So the language becomes less important, or I won't even say less important, but it's more important about what it's actually functioning for. So I think those three things, like how does it fit into, you know, the piece of the platform? And then also traditionally, like, you know, do I know it? Do enough people know it? Will it be easy to hire for, you know? And then does it meet the need?
Yeah, that's my favorite, what you said at the end there. Are there people around that know it?
Right.
Are you going to be able to hire programmers that know it in your area, or are they easily accessible? Is it some, you know, margins programming language that there's not going to be programmers around, and you only realize that after, right?
Right.
Advice is so huge. Like, yeah, of course, if you are a startup founder or co-founder that happens to be a programmer, it's a no-brainer, right? You go with what you know.
Sure.
If you're not, if you're just, you know, someone who has a great idea and you don't know how programming works, you have to get the right advice, right?
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think that's totally right on.
Okay, so the question I love to ask people like yourself is, what would be your best advice for startups? It doesn't have to be 1, 2, 3 things. It could be one thing, it could be three things, top five, whatever. But if I'm a startup and I'm just starting my startup journey and I come across this podcast, what's the best advice you wish that person will take from you? And it could be more than one thing. But.
Sure. I think I could boil it down to one. There's lots of things I would say. But there's one thing that I can say for myself and for all the people that I've interviewed that have come out of the interviews, and it's sort of mixed into a couple of phrases. It's you know, I don't want to steal Nike's trademark, but just do it, do it, and do it quickly. So
do it and do it quickly. Wow.
Yeah. So you know, I think people in that the do it and do it quickly thing kind of translates to a couple things. I think doing it, it's like you can get caught up in analysis paralysis of trying to perfect and trying to build the perfectly engineered solution or the perfectly designed solution. When really you're going to get it out there and you're going to learn a lot more from it being out in the wild than you are from it being in your hands being perfected. So do it and then do it as fast as you can, because probably someone else is doing it right next to you in the office, right next to you. You're in a race, you know? Yeah. So you got to get it out there. You got to get out there quick. And so that would be the thing I would say. And it's part of not being afraid to do it either. Just like there's so many resources out there nowadays. Like you can get your hands on so much more these days than you could in the past. Go grab a hold of those resources and just go try it. You know, you're going to learn a ton. I've had a bunch of failed stuff that I've done on the side too, that I learned way more from than the successes. And the successes were there because of all the failed stuff. So anyway, just go do it.
Yeah, that's great advice, because I think it also harkens a little bit to, you know, you've got this idea that has 20 moving parts and it's complex. And I often say, and I love MVPs. I love them not only because they help people go for financing. It has nothing to do with financing. It just lets people really laser focus on, okay, what are the things, okay, there's 20 very complex things, but what are the most important that I can just get it to market? And I guess that's the just do it sort of genre, right? It's like, get out an MVP, get people to start using it, get some feedback about it. Because what you think in the planning phase, those 20 things, you'll realize once it's launched that those 20 things don't even make sense. Maybe 10 of them do, but the other 10 that you spent time and money developing don't mean anything.
Exactly.
So exactly. What do you think of the MVP process? Do you feel the same way? Do you feel like it's super important that a startup should always have an MVP?
I that's a great question. I do for the most part. You know, and I think until recently I would have said yes, no matter what. You need an MVP, you need to get out there. But I've interviewed a couple of people here recently. In fact, one really recently, Yoshi Yokokawa from Alpaca Markets. He and his team are building essentially the Stripe of financial trading, if that makes sense. So like an API for financial trading. And you know, there are some of those out there, but there's not one that's trying to be the infrastructure for that. And that's what his goal is. And he really opened my eyes to a different way of thinking there, because he said, you know, our MVP was basically non-existent. It was either it works or it doesn't. Mm-hmm. And they had to get it to where their solution had to be registered as a broker. They had to go through all of this, you know, XYZ stuff to get their solution, even be able to work. So, you know, I think there are situations where an MVP, you know, really just has to be the solution, you know, and I think there's another guy interviewed, his name's Peter Voss. He works for, or started a company called iGo, and in AI, like you can have an MVP, but you don't really want to put it out there until you've done some R&D on it and you can really make it into a commercial product, which I think his team took 5 years to do that. So there's certain instances where the MVP idea still applies, but doesn't exactly apply the way we're talking about it. But I'd say for the majority, you get your solution out there, especially if it's a consumer solution or a B2B solution, and let the people tell you what they want you to do next.
Yeah, that's a great point. That's a great point. Yeah, it also makes you, I find it makes startup founders focus too. They can be more narrow-minded and faster, be developed faster, get it out there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great advice. So Noah, there was, when I was looking through your LinkedIn profile, there was something that you did, part of your volunteer experience, which is great, by the way. I love seeing volunteer experience on LinkedIn profiles. In early 2020, before COVID, obviously you spoke at Texas A&M. Mm-hmm. And so you were a guest speaker at Texas A&M, and one of the topics that you covered was how to build the right team for your startup. I don't know if people realize how important that is. For me personally, the business that I'm in web development, a lot of times we get calls from people that are just, you know, they need to be rescued. They're lost. They've just gone down the wrong path. So how to choose the right team for your startup, and obviously the right technology team for your startup. Mm-hmm. That comes with, like, okay, who you're going to hire, what programming language are you going to use? It's so important. Can you give us just a quick summary of the answer to that? How do you build the right team for your startup?
Sure. Absolutely. Yeah. So, yeah, I spoke at the Texas A&M Tech Summit, and as you said, the topic was how to build your startup team. And I've learned at Variable a non-traditional approach, essentially. I took a non-traditional approach to building my team at Variable. Early on, you know, we came across some really interesting candidates that are still with our team today, that had been learning development at a bootcamp. And I'd say prior to Variable, I was more in a traditional thinking, you need a computer science degree or a computer engineering degree or something of in the pedigree, we'll say, that, yeah, you know, would tell me that you can do the role. When I started talking to these individuals coming out of the bootcamp, you know, noticing that they were, you know, career changing type developers, I was interested. I was like, okay, these people seem really sharp.
Career changing developers?
So for example, we've had individuals that were teachers for 10 years or so.
Oh, okay.
And then went to a Dev Mountain bootcamp and then learned the programming and then came and changed their career, right? Or biomedical research or recruiting. It could have been all kinds of stuff, right? When we started interviewing these folks, I started to notice, you know, wow, these people are really sharp, really smart, and they're able to connect with what we're trying to do at Variable in a very different way. We took some chances on some early individuals, and it worked out fantastic. Those individuals are still with us today. I've hired nine to 10 people from the bootcamp itself. Career-changing developers, excuse me. And I think actually I said programmers and developers on subconsciously on purpose, because I believe that what the people that I've hired are developers. They're not programmers, right? I feel like the difference is programmers are going to take some specs and build something. They don't test it. They don't think about the strategy. They don't think about the solution from a user standpoint. Whereas developers are there with you to think about and communicate what you're trying to build, not only to the end users, but internally and to our business counterparts and things like that. Wow. So
no one has ever made that that comparable between programmers and developers. I'm going to steal that one for you.
You should. I stole it from somebody else. So.
Oh, man, that is so awesome. Programmer versus developer. That is amazing.
I'll send you the article. It's by Eric Sink. And I don't know Eric. I found this article on in the Google sphere, right? Okay. But he compares programmers and developers, and it's part of our tech team manifesto here at Variable. Yeah. And, again, understanding the strategy and what the non-traditional part was, like looking at the person and looking at the raw materials that they have, from their life experiences. And then, you know, they're able to do the job, but are they able to see what we're trying to accomplish? Are they able to, from the raw materials, do they have the grit necessary and the hunger necessary to figure out stuff that they don't know? And that's really where the kind of the heart behind building the team, the presentation I gave at the Tech Summit was looking at the raw materials of the people.
Yeah, it's super important. What about the reputation of startups grinding people to the bone type of thing, and you know what, there's no 40 hour week, it's 80, 100 hour a week, and it's is that still happening, or was that gone with the 90s type of philosophy?
it's still happening at some startups. It doesn't happen here. And I won't say in the early days we didn't work our butt off. We had a lot of things to fix that weren't working. We had a lot of things to prove, and we had a lot of things to make sure that we had a tight core product to stand on. So we worked a lot, and that's part of the early stage startup is getting it done. But what we truly believe, at least with our team culture, is work life harmony. And you notice I didn't say work life balance, because I don't think that exists. I think work life harmony is the important thing that you look for. And one of our early investors, Brian Spaley, actually communicated that to me. It was work life harmony. If you have a lot to do, a lot of work to do, you should work a lot. If you don't have a lot of work to do, there may not be a reason to work a lot. And figuring out how all that integrates in with your life is part of choosing the right job, is part of choosing, the right things you want in your life. It's all about making that dance fit together. So that's what I think when I think of how we do startup here. Now, I will say that there are startups out there that, 100-hour weeks all the time. not ours.
Let me ask you a little quick advice now for a programmer or developer, because now okay. I know there's two separate things. should they avoid startups? Or if they're going towards a startup because that's where that high-paying job might be at that given moment, depending on the market they're in, what should they look for? What should they steer away from when considering becoming an employee of a startup?
That's a great question. I think it depends on the person, really. I think if you're a person that can work in a highly sort of ambiguous environment, a constantly changing environment that, may or may not be 8 to 5, sometimes it might be 8 to midnight and the next day it's, 10 to 4 or something, it just depends on where the work is needed and you want to be learning different things. I would say a startup is the place for you because, if you want to get in and learn quickly and do a bunch of fun stuff and really interesting things, the startup's the way to go. If you're looking for more structure, if you need more structure, if you need a different pace, then maybe a bigger company is more for you, or a bigger, corporation is more the speed for you. Neither one of them is wrong or better or worse. I've done both and I've gotten really great things out of both. But they're just different. It's kind of comes down to what you're looking for.
That's great advice. And it's funny. Most of the times I ask people that question, so far it's always been a little bit different. And I really appreciate yours. And I appreciate the time that you spent with us today. And I can't wait to see this video, and I can't wait to get it out to both our collective listeners and viewers, because I think there's a lot of value in here. And we're gonna post your LinkedIn profile, your contact information in the video. So if anyone wants to reach out to you, it's gonna be very easy to do it.
Cool. Thanks, Tony. This has been super fun. Enjoyed the conversation. Hope to do it again soon.
Thank you, Noah. Have a great weekend.
All right, you too.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.